talk of flag. Welcome to Voices from the Frontline segment on the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and we're on the web at kpfk.org. My name is Damon Azali Rojas, and I'm here with my co-host, Manuel Criollo. On May 11, 2007, community groups and activists gathered in front of the Speaker of Assemblies, Fabian Nunez's office, to protest the passage of AB 900, which is to push forward the creation of 53,000 new jail beds in California. Joining us for our first segment to speak about the fight to overturn AB 900 is John Lum, who's a public policy coordinator for the Coalition for Effective Public Safety. For our second segment, we'll flow right into Kim McGill from the Youth Justice Coalition and Guillermo Suarez from the People's Commission in Defense of Human Rights to speak about police brutality and the aftermath of the May 1st police violence and repression. And we'll finally be ending our show and taking comments from you on both of these subjects about police state, prison state, and all the rest that's in between. So we'll be right back with John Lum. So welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines, and John Lum is on the phone. John, welcome to the show. John Lum.
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm doing poorly, thank you.
I feel the sentiment. So we wanted to talk to you a little bit about what's been going, because you're kind of the progressive eyes and ears in Sacramento. And so we want to talk to you a little bit about AB 900. So why don't you just start off and tell us, what was this bill that no one of us really heard about till it was all over?
Well, AB 900 was crafted by members of the legislature, the leadership, the Senate President Don Parata, and the Speaker of the Assembly, Fabian Nunez, and others, in concert with the governor, to quickly ram through, if you will, a bill that would ultimately build some 53,000 new prison and jail beds in California, and done so in a manner that there were no hearings, no notices, couldn't even get a copy of the bill to read until the day after they had already approved it. So both in process and substance, it was one of the most disastrous things I've ever seen in my 30 years working in government across this country.
So in terms of the actual process, and to me, it seems like even though public comment and public input is still somewhat limiting, because I think a lot of times we've seen, we'll go and testify, you know, you're going to kill us, you're going to kill our kids.
Right.
And they're like, okay, thank you for your comment, next in line. What about, I mean, it seems to me that even with that, there should have been some kind of public comment. So how did they get around that?
Well, they and I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, what they allege in the final bill that was adopted and approved in the Assembly by a vote of 70-1 and in the Senate by a vote of 27-10, they cite all kinds of things in the Constitution that allow them to waive all the legal requirements of notice and hearings and posting and all the other kinds of requirements that you would see in any kind of other bill that might go through the legislature. So they just cite all of that. And then on top of it, it's not just, you know, the process type things, the issue, but I mean, they also use lease revenue bonds to pay for the building of all of these beds. And the bill is silent in terms of what the operating cost will be once all these beds come online. But, you know, beyond all of that, and am I surprised? No, I'm not surprised they did this, but your point's so well taken that even when you have hearings, you feel at best that you're ignored. But, you know, it's really a shame for California. It's a shame for the United States. It's a sad day for democracy and for public safety. There's nothing about this bill that in any way talks about or ensures for any of us that we're going to have safer communities, mindless, more effective use of tax dollars, when it could have been a very thoughtful process talking about, you know, what's going on in California? How can we have safer communities? How can we have a lesser dependence upon incarceration? Because there's no evidence that incarceration unto itself makes us safer. How can we have more effective investment in prevention that really would make us safer? How can we save money? There was just none of that discussion. No discussion about the disproportionate so-called minority impact in incarceration in California, which is huge. Nothing. Just silent on all those issues. Doesn't even, Damon, go to the point we all know that California's correctional system is under virtually every aspect of its operation is under court oversight for unconstitutional conditions. So you would think at a minimum, even if you supported building all these new beds, which make no sense, but if you did, you would want to build into a bill and say, let's make sure we run them so we don't build new things that are immediately found to be unconstitutional again. They didn't even do that.
So then with all the context of this, then why in the Democratic-led legislature did this just get pushed through without any debate, discussion, even, you know, the rumors of, you know, threats of offices being changed and whatnot? Why did the Democrats, besides, you know, generally speaking, want to build things, why did they push this through so fast?
You know, it's speculative on my part, and anybody's speculation is as worthy as I imagine mine might be. You know, my sense is that there's maybe some kind of a side deal that they struck with the governor. You give me this, I give you that. Maybe it's a term limit thing. Maybe it's something totally unrelated to anything to do with corrections. That's a possibility. There's, of course, the stuff that floats out there that, my gosh, if we didn't do this, the federal courts are going to take over the system by June, which is totally false, and it's all myth. And so that
is that where Peralta's speech came from?
Well, I think that's where that comes from. But the fact is that, yes, there will be some hearings in June by three different courts, and, yes, they will be considering whether the overcrowding in California's prisons rises to the level of unconstitutional conditions, which clearly anybody with any sense of humanity would say, yes, it does. And therefore, the courts might take over the system and order a cap, which they should do, should have done years ago, quite frankly, if they were doing their job. But there's nothing in this bill except for transferring 8,000 people to private prisons in other states. There's nothing in the bill that would remedy, you know, lead to a quick resolution of the overcrowding conditions. And even today, when the governor released his May revised budget, he deleted his recommendation for an advisory sentencing commission, which at best was weak, but he at least recommended it in his January budget. He deleted it. And he also deleted a provision that he put in his January budget that could have led to a reduction of the population, and that is to stop placing people who have never been convicted of a nonviolent offense on parole. He deleted that provision as well today.
We have John Lum. He's a public policy coordinator for the Coalition for Effective Public Safety and California's United for a Responsible Budget. Well, you know, John, me and Damon were talking in the ride here how crazy the conditions have flipped, you know, in less than 3 years, where in many ways a lot of people were saying, well, Schwarzenegger is going to be really tough, but there might be a moment where there might be some major reform. The courts have been making at least some very decent, you know, rulings in terms of the unconstitutional status of this thing. And we're in some ways in a height of activity against the prison construction in California. How do we get to this point where, again, as Damon I think was asking earlier, is that where the conditions were so favorable and now all of a sudden here we're going to have our people shipped out to other states?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's driven by what has obviously become a major economic force in California and across this country, and that's incarceration. I've worked in corrections, started in the system in 1971 in North Carolina, and worked 30 years in the system. And the system has grown to a point where the economic interests, both private and in the public sector, for incarceration and for institutions and for things that related to it, have become so huge that that unto itself, I think, is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it kind of drives bureaucracies and obviously the contributions that flow into so-called lawmakers greatly influence that. And then on the other side of it, there's not a strong outpouring of people saying, wait a minute, this doesn't work. What are you doing? This isn't making us safer, and this is eating so much of the money. And mind you, these are the very dollars, and people will get this impact later down the road. I don't know if they care, but they will get the impact. There'll be less money for education, less money for schools, less money for colleges, less money for foster care, less money for people on substance, less money for drug treatment. It will eat up so much money. $43,000 per year is the per capita cost for one person incarcerated in the state system, and that's adult. It's like $170,000 on the juvenile side. And out of that, we get a 70% failure rate. Now, nobody with any logical sense why would you want to continue doing something like that? And I think we should, you know, this was a great opportunity, this so-called crisis, to sit back and say, what works, what doesn't work? So many other states across this country have made reforms by looking at their sentencing laws and looking at the impact of incarceration, looking at the impact of alternative sentences, looking at the impact of drug treatment and other treatment interventions, and looking at very meaningful things that evidence shows work to reduce crime, to reduce the dependence on the system. We chose not to do that in California, and that's what this governor and this legislature chose to do, is to simply look at this as a storage problem, and it's all about beds. And there's no evidence that shows simply by incarcerating people and investing those amounts of money in beds that you make us safer.
And one of the interesting things is thinking about how California situates itself in terms of number of prison beds, number of people in prison compared to the world.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, at this point, I think it's somewhere between 172 and 174,000 people in prison in California.
Right.
And then this would be another 53,000, not
correct.
To mention the 8,000 folks who who are now, before it was the governor doing an emergency kind of decoration to ship people out, and
right.
It had to be voluntarily. Now they can just do it whenever. I think it's really important just for our listeners to know in terms of this and how this affects, you know, it's affecting the whole state, but it affects Los Angeles County at such a higher level, because we look at a lot of the people who are put into prison and jails are from LA County. So in terms of, I saw one of your flyers that you put out for the action at Familia Nunez's office.
Yeah.
And I saw that of the 53,000 beds, 17,278 would be for folks who are in LA County. Of the 53,000 beds, 19,822 would be for Latinos, and 15,211 will be for blacks. So I think when we look at how kind of race filters in on every level,
yes,
of the criminal justice system, I think it's really, really important. And I guess my question to you in our kind of last couple minutes would be, one of the things that we've been trying to say is, like, you can't separate police and prisons from your other campaign work. So a lot of other organizations might be fighting, you know, the death penalty, or might even fighting for immigrant rights or whatever. But when you look at, like, all the stuff you're talking about, the more money that goes to prisons, this is like $7 billion for the construction of this. Something like, at least I think estimates were $2 billion per year operation.
Right.
Unless you're actually dealing with this on every level, it's your work with this cannot succeed. Not only will your people be locked up, but then also in terms of, if we look at the people who are actually making political change, those are the people that the state kind of goes after. So I just want to, just with the last couple minutes, on what would be some of the things that you think, or have you seen in your experience, that have actually moved people and organizations to really deal with this head on, as well as other people who are not necessarily directly, I'm going to say directly affected, because everybody's directly affected, but people who are just like, wow, okay, I get it. I need to do something about this. What has been your experience in terms of seeing people move to action on this?
Well, your point is so well taken, and therein is the challenge. And certainly the two coalitions that I work with, the Coalition for Effective Public Safety and Californians United for a Responsible Budget, are trying to do that by bringing groups with many different philosophies and approaches and interests and priorities together to try to align at least on this issue. And it's tough because, you know, you have everything from reformists to abolitionists to labor organizations and others. But I think what's real important, and you so well stated it, is to branch the movement out to others. The business community needs to be concerned about this issue. Where are the churches? They need to be concerned. The organizations that supposedly and in most cases do well speaking up on issues of racism, they need to be concerned about it. There's no other place I know of in government that sanctions the institutionalism of racism than in the correction system. It's such a manifestation of that. I mean, even the governor in Wisconsin was so concerned about it in his state system, he at least asked for a study on it. Our governor doesn't even raise it as an interest of concern, not even a matter of concern that 27% of the people who are incarcerated in the state prison system are African American and 37% Latino, and almost 90% in the juvenile system are non-white. Doesn't even get on the radar screen. So this has got to branch out, and I think people maybe now might get more affected by it when they start to feel it in their pocketbook. But I'm not sure. I mean, we had a good turnout last Friday at the speaker's office in Los Angeles, but there should have been thousands of people there, quite frankly, who are outraged by the process and outraged by what this is going to do to California and who's it going to lock up. And we know who that is, and how far is this going, and how much of our liberties and freedom are we willing to continue to give up in the pursuit of this nonsense? And again, it has nothing to do with public safety. It has to do with the bucks that people are making on the side of it.
So, John, do you have a website that people get more information or content?
We do. The Californians United for a Responsible Budget. You can input that, and then also the Coalition for Effective Public Safety. There are two websites for both of those coalitions.
All right. Well, John Lum, thank you so much for being
on
the show.
And thank you for continuing to keep this on the radar screen. The press, quite frankly, final comment, as somebody who worked in government for years, and I'm now embarrassed of how government behaves in California, but this prison crisis in California is a manifestation of the failure of all branches of government. It can't be viewed any other way. And thank God for the press, because you've kept this issue in the public's forefront, or there would be no light shone on it at all. So thanks a lot for what you're doing.
Okay. So that was John Lum. This is Damon Azali Rojas and Manuel Criollo. And we'll be right back after the break with Kim McGill and Guillermo Suarez. See you in a minute.